Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order Monday afternoon, the 16th of February, 2026. With me today this afternoon is Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, there's co-chairs, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and Stedman. We have one item on the agenda today. We have invited the Alaska Retirement Management Board to come talk to us about the retirement system and what's going on in their world. And I'd like to go ahead and welcome the board chairman, Mr. Brian Williams. If you can come forward. And do you think he has a trusty aide he can bring up if he needs a lifeline or some assistance? And with that, Mr. Williams, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and we'll try to get through your slide deck today.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair Stedman and members of the committee. I'm Bob Williams, Chair of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, for the record.
Good morning. My name is Alicia Jones. I'm the board liaison. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I have two topics for you this morning, this afternoon. First, I'll walk through the Armed Board's amortization policy, specifically the shift to 15-year layering and the updated payroll growth assumption. That will take the bulk of this presentation. And then I'll also share with you four resolutions the Armed Board has adopted, making recommendations for improvements to the defined contribution retirement system. This first slide is hot off the press. I was able to ask our actuary, Gallagher, to get it to me a little bit early. I received it on Thursday, and it'll be in the March Armed Board packet. And this is a fundamental pension funding equation. Everything coming in on one side has to equal everything going out on the other. At our assumed rate of 7.25%, both sides balance, $17.9 billion for PERS, $8.3 billion for TERS. Now, you might wonder how the equation balances when we still have an unfunded liability. It balances because the contribution projections on the left side already include the payments needed to fund that unfunded liability. The actuarial calculations build those payments in, so the system is in an actuarial balance. What the 7.25% does is account for time, the time value of money. If we owe millions of dollars in benefits decades from now, what's that worth today? If we assume we can earn 7.25% on our investment between now and then, we need a lot less money sitting in the account today because we're counting on decades of compound investment growth to do much of the heavy lifting. So these numbers look smaller because the expected investment earnings are embedded in the math. They're invisible, baked into the discount rate. The contribution splits are on the side, if anyone wants to reference those. The next slide makes those invisible investment earnings visible. This slide came from a collaborative request from the Armed Board and our Chief Investment Officer, Zach Hanna. We asked the actuary, Gallagher, to rerun the exact same analysis, same system, same benefits, same contributions, but discount at the 2.5% inflation rate instead of 7.25%. When you discount at just inflation, you're saying, don't give the investments any credit beyond keeping up with inflation. Show me what things cost in today's purchasing power. That makes all the future numbers much larger, which is why the PERS goes from $17.9 billion to $32.3 billion, and the TERS from $8.3 billion to $14.5 billion. No money appeared or disappeared, the equation still balances. But here's why we wanted to see it this way. Look at what shows up as a separate line item that was invisible on the previous slide. Inflation-adjusted future investment earnings, $12.7 billion for PERS, $5.7 billion for TERS. That's the investment return that was hidden inside the discount rate on slide three, and now you can see it. If you look at PERS, current assets at $12.3 billion, future contributions $7.3 billion, future investment earnings, $12.7 billion. Investment returns represent more than our total current assets. They represent more than all future contributions combined. TERS tells the same story, $5.7 billion in expected investment earnings versus $6.5 billion for current assets and $2.3 billion in contributions. I think the takeaway is clear. Meeting our 7.25% return assumption is an important piece of funding these pensions. The Department of Revenue investment team is critical to the overall success of this system. That's why the ARM board takes the investment return assumption so seriously, and it's why the rolling return data I'm about to show you matters.
Okay, some of the concerns we've had is that targeted rate of return has been much higher in the past and has been ratcheted down. And when we go back in time, if we go back a decade, go back a decade and a half, go back two decades, and look at where we're forecasted to be today, we are not where we were forecasted to be today. So there is some concern on that subject. As an example, you know, according to this presentation here, if all the assumptions hold true, we would be in balance. We wouldn't be growing an unfunded liability. Is that correct?
This slide is showing paying off the unfunded liability in the time frame with this. So those future contributions include that to pay off the unfunded liability by fiscal year 2039.
So if we go back 10 years and look at a presentation then and go forward 10 years, the concern is, like I mentioned earlier, talking to you, the PERS, well, I can do TERS because it's easier. TERS is an identical number, $1,629,000,000 in 2015, after we put in $1 billion extra. In 25, it's the same number. It hasn't moved. The PERS has actually increased in liability, and we've spent a couple $1 billion since then. So there's a disconnect between the results we're seeing here at the table to retire that unfunded liability and the projections being given us over and over again. And it's not a derogatory statement. It's just there's a lot of variables going on, and apparently there hasn't been enough contributions to retire the unfunded liability over the plan schedule, the way it looks.
Yes, I received a few questions midday Friday after I'd already submitted this slide deck. I tried to pull some information from some old actuarial packets to answer some of those questions. I have that in some of my comments. I think I've tried within this presentation to try and get to some of the things that I think that are very clear and I think you're concerned with and the board is also concerned with. When you're putting substantial funds towards something, you like to see progress. And there's some times where we haven't seen that progress, and I will try to get to a description that has some of the factors that lead to that.
Okay.
And that should be in this presentation.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay. So now let me show you why smoothing matters and why it's essential to understanding our amortization approach. The challenge every pension system faces is that the budgets are annual, but the markets are not predictable on an annual basis. In 2009, the fund lost 20.6%. In 2021, it gained 27.6%. If we pass these swings straight through to employer contribution rates, we would have municipalities and school districts facing massive, unpredictable budget shocks. And with the cap, the state would be facing massive, unpredictable budget shocks. So the ARM board uses five-year smoothing. We take each year's gain on loss relative to the expected return and spread it evenly over 5 years, 20% per year. This doesn't hide anything. The entire gain or loss is fully recognized. We're just phasing it in to produce steadier, more predictable contribution rates and state assistance payments.
And what do you call that?
Smoothing.
And we get, when we look at it, we look at our actuarial or the market value of our assets, and we look at the smoothing value of our assets. I think you report both those, don't you?
We report the actuarial value of the assets, and we also report it by market so you can see them. And we look at them, particularly in funding ratios, we want to see that they're close together. There isn't something way off, but this smoothing is to help take some of those shocks out of the system. Mm-hmm. Here's what that looks like in practice. When the fund lost 20.6% in 2009 against an expected return of 8.25%, we recognized 20% of that shortfall immediately and deferred the remaining 80% across the next 4 years. That prevented an enormous spike in rates that would have hit employers all at once. Same principle in reverse for 2021's 27.6% gain. Instead of a one-year dip in contributions followed by a painful rebound, the gain phased in gradually. The recognition schedule is straightforward, 20% each year for 5 years, totaling 100%. Smoothing changes the timing, never the total amount. Now we're going to look at the ARM Board's actual returns while using rolling averages, starting with 1 year and extending all the way out to 30 years. Just watch what happens to the volatility. When Chair Stedman said that this presentation would be riveting, I view this portion of the presentation as having the highest probability to rivet you in some capacity. So here are the raw returns going back to 1985. As you can see, it's a wild ride. The worst year was negative 20.6%. The best was 29.8%. That's a range of over 50 percentage points. The mean is 9.4%, well above our 7.2% assumption. But in any given year, you could almost land anywhere on that chart. This is what employers would face without smoothing. Rolling two-year returns, just averaging over 2 years, the worst case narrows. Already you see the extremes pulling in. At 3 years, the worst is now only negative 5%. We're starting to eliminate the deep losses. Rolling five-year returns, this is the one that corresponds to our actual smoothing policy. Over any five-year rolling period since 1985, the ARM Board has never had a negative return. The worst five-year average was positive 0.9%. Not an awesome number, nothing to write home about, but it's still positive. And the best was 16.1%. The range is down to 15 percentage points, and the mean is 8.5%. Seven-year returns range down to under 10 percentage points. The worst period still returns 4.2%. 10-year returns. Over a decade, returns converge tightly around the long-term expectation. Worst 10-year period was still 2.7% positive. 20-year returns. The range is under 5 percentage points. Every 20-year window came in between 5.7% and 10.7%. And here we are at rolling 30-year returns. And this is the one I really want you to see. Over 30 years, the ARM Board returns have ranged between 7.4% to 8.9%. That is a range of just 1.5 percentage points. The mean is 7.9%. Our current assumption is 7.25%. The 30-year track record validates the assumptions we're using. This table kind of brings that all together, showing the range going from 50 points to 15, all the way down to 1.5 at 30 years. Time compresses volatility, and the long-term mean converges right around where our assumption sits. Sometimes there are shocks, but smoothing helps prevent them from destabilizing employer budgets.
I don't think there's a concern at the table over the years of using smoothing.
Mm-hmm.
Actuaries do that from multiple angles, you know, to try to decrease the volatility. And we have all our non-state employers trying to make payroll and make the payments and along with the state. But if you look at the 10-year rolling average, 8.2, which sounds pretty good, but when we look at our liability, it's not moving. So that's the underlying indigestion here at the table. These look fine. So something else is going on.
I would like, Chair Stedman, to thank you for foreshadowing a future part of my presentation that I think will shed some light on that.
Okay.
Now let me put our recent policy decisions in context. The Armed Board has taken actions in both directions, reducing costs where appropriate and strengthening the system where needed. In 2021, the Board zeroed out the defined benefit health care normal cost because those trusts were more than fully funded. That reduced short-term cost $88.8 million in the first year alone and has continued to produce tens of millions of dollars in annual cost reductions. Also in 2025, we recommended restructuring the judicial retirement system's amortization schedule after it was projected to be fully funded. There was no reason to keep making multi-million dollar payments, I think they were a little under $3 million, on an unfunded liability that no longer existed. With layering, sometimes those things happen, but the board gives recommendations on the judicial retirement system, and our thoughts were, if this is overfunded and you have some old layers there that you're making a $3 payment on, but you're truly overfunded, we should restructure this so that you're not making those payments.
And I haven't looked at the judicial retirement system in years. It's small relative to PERS system for all state workers and non-state employers. As I recall, we fully funded it twice to erase the unfunded liability over the last 20 years, and it slipped back into underfunding fairly quickly. So currently it's at a funding ratio close to 100%. Is that what you're saying? Because I haven't looked. I'm just asking. I'll just
say I thought I might get a question on this, but the judicial retirement system, it's different than a lot of other plans in that it's for judges, so it's a fixed amount. There's like 69 judges, and it's an open defined benefit plan. And it depends. Most our PERS and TERS are dependent on what's your high 3 years or what's your high 5 years. With judges, if after 15 years, they can have it caps at 75%, and it's of the current salary. So if there's a salary increase, it has a much bigger impact on the judicial system than any of the other systems. And so it you're right, it is small. And sometimes when I looked at some of the way it pivots and is a little bit volatile, I'm like, why isn't this a bigger issue? I think it's because it is small. But if you look at the contribution rates, they're a little bit volatile and they move around. It's different in that it's much more dependent on the salary growth of current judges, because when you give a salary increase to current judges, that's affecting all the retired judges too. So that's a different system. And after 15 years, they're at 75%.
And is it capped at 75?
It's capped at 75%.
So we did not, just for those at the table that haven't been around this issue as long as some of us, we did not replace the judicial retirement system when we rewrote the pension plan 20 years ago. We have not adjusted that. So that's the original. I think they just have Tier 1, mm-hmm. whatever the judge, whoever call it, Tier 1, but Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, you were mentioning 100% is like the funding target. Is there an industry standard where some lesser amount is considered adequate or the de facto gold standard, or do you shoot for 100% or 105? So what's the optimal target to manage the system for?
So I guess through the chair, Senator Kaufman, this came up when we saw that our healthcare trusts were overfunded, and there was an analogy I used that got quoted a lot, and I've changed the analogy since then, but the idea was that the pension fund was unfunded, so if it was a glass of water and it's full, why would you keep adding water to it? And so the idea was 100% was you're fully funded. There's enough variables and changes. So I would now say if I'm on Alaska Airlines jet flying from Seattle to Anchorage and I land and they still have 10 gallons of jet fuel in the tank, I don't necessarily think of that jet as overfueled. But we were seeing, you know, high levels of funding that putting in for the normal cost did not necessarily make sense. I have seen policymakers make the thing of like, we think 90% is good enough, or we think this amount is good enough. I've seen other policymakers say you still have unfunded liability and it's this amount of dollars. So the board has not necessarily taken a position on this beyond zeroing out the normal cost for the overfunded health trust systems.
Okay. Go ahead. Oh, you got a follow-up? Okay. Go ahead and continue.
Okay. Slide 19. And, okay. I just talked about the judicial. We review these decisions every year when the numbers support reducing costs, and we act on that. Chair Steadman, I want to take a moment to address two questions the committee sent midday Friday that I did not have a chance to put in this presentation. And I used to be a math teacher, but I'm not an actuary. But I tried to dig and look at some historical actuarial packets myself to make sure I was comparing the correct projections and contribution categories. And I'm going to cite the sources just in case Gallagher or someone else wants to verify. But one of the questions was, in 2015, when did the ARM board project the unfunded liability would be paid off? And I looked at the April 22nd, 2015 actuarial packet, page 44 of the 372-page packet. Under level percent of pay projections, the funded ratio reaches 100% in FY 2040. So in 2015, the system was projected to eliminate the unfunded liability by fiscal year 2039 and be fully funded in fiscal year 2040. The second question I received, what did we project for the unfunded liability payment in fiscal year 2025? What I can say from the same April 2015 packet, page 34, the projected fiscal year 2025 additional state assistance was $345.3 million. The board actually set the fiscal year 2025 rate in September 2023. From the September 13th, 2023 actuarial packet, page 154, the board selected alternative one, which zeroed out healthcare normal cost. Under that adopted alternative, fiscal year 25, additional state contributions were $178.1 million, about $167 million less than the 2015 projection. If the question was actually focused in on what the board did in 2025, in 2025, we set the fiscal year 2027 assumption. The April 2015 packet projected fiscal year 2027 additional state assistance at $378.8 million from page 34. Under Scenario 1D, which the board adopted in September 2025, fiscal year 2027 additional state contributions total approximately $270 million, $106 million for PERS, $164 million for TERS, shown on page 84 and 88 of the September 2025 packet. That's roughly $109 million less than what was projected in 2015. And I imagine many of you are thinking, well, it doesn't feel that much less, but there's some reasons for why projections differ than what you actually experience. Payroll growth can be different, investment returns, assumption updates, amortization policies. But I think the most significant structural factor is the substantial overfunding of healthcare trusts and the board's decision beginning in 2021 to zero out healthcare normal cost. The 2015 projections assumed ongoing healthcare normal cost payments. Eliminating those payments materially reduced additional state contributions in every year since then. It is a decision we make every year, and so if the status changed and we implemented normal cost for the DB healthcare system, it would feel like a shock. But we look at that every year, and right now they are well funded. I hope that answers the two questions.
It does, mostly. I don't think there's a concern over the health care. The concentration here of concern is over the pension, mm-hmm. getting that in a position maybe similar to the health care, right, where there's close to a surplus. So maybe you can get back to us on what the liability projection was for 2025 in 2015.
Okay.
They missed that part of the question. I should have edited it. I get a little bitter. Thought about it. But there's the cash flow payments, but then there's the annual payments to retire the unfunded liability, but then there's the unfunded liability itself. Is it going up or down as we target our payment schedule?
Thank you. And we, Armed Board Liaison, Alicia Jones is noting that question, and I think that is one that the State Actuary Gallagher will probably respond to instead of
that's fine.
Me digging into things
no,
over the
fine.
Weekend.
That's fine. And then if you're going to do that, let's go back to 2010, look at 2025, and go to 2015, check 225 at 2025, then 2020 what it was supposed to be.
Okay.
Because if we listened and looked at all this stuff, we wouldn't even know there was an issue out there, right?
Right.
We got to look under the covers, and there is concern, and I think you're going to address it as your contribution total this year was recommended by the Armed Board at $270 million, and the administration has put in $232 million. So there's a discrepancy there, and clearly $270 million will retire a liability faster than $230.
Yes. I will try to address some of those okay. issues you've done, and I will move forward, I guess, to the talking about some things that we've done that have increased the cost this year, but we feel will save money in the long run. Fiduciary responsibility also means making harder decisions. Two adjustments increasing near-term costs but are designed to save money over the long term. First, the payroll growth assumption. For years, the system assumed payroll would grow at 2.75% annually, but the 10-year average for PERS and TERS has been significantly less than that. When you assume payroll will be bigger than it actually turns out to be, the dollar contributions you're counting on in later years never fully materialize. Updating this assumption to match reality improves the accuracy of our projections. Second, the shift from 25-year to 15-year layering for new unfunded liabilities. Under the old approach, payments were heavily backloaded. These changes come from the same fiduciary discipline that produced the cost reductions I previously described. So, in 2006, the Armed Board adopted a 25-year schedule to pay off unfunded liabilities with level percent of pay by 2030. But by 2007 and 2008, contribution rates had surged to unsustainable levels. Fairbanks was facing PERS rates of 180% of payroll. Anchorage School District saw TERS rates jump from 26% to 54%. The legislature responded by capping employer rates at 22% for PERS and 12.56% for TERS, with the state covering the difference. In 2012, the board adopted level dollar amortization to be more aggressive. That's like your mortgage where you make the same payment every payment. Then in 2014, the legislature made two important moves. It infused $3 billion into the system, and it changed the amortization method back to level percent of pay while extending the timeline from 2030 to 2039.
Then we have a question to Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Yes, actually, I was back on the other slide. Question I had. So when discussing payroll growth assumption, so payroll growth, you're talking about like the total population and the cost of all employees when you use the term payroll?
Yes, it is. Payroll growth is markedly different than salary growth. Salary is the way someone's own salary changes over time. Payroll growth is looking at the entire pool and how has it changed over time. And so the assumption with level percent of pay is that the payroll is going to grow over time so that we can have a higher payment far off in the future that would be a similar percentage of what we'd be paying today. So today's contribution can be smaller because we're expecting payroll to be larger down the line.
Just curious about the mitigating or antagonistic effects of salary or paycheck growth. So compensation pattern risks. So when people's overtime really bumps up their rate of pay relative to the system. So you're not adding bodies to the system, but you're adding a financial load through that pattern risk. So is that incorporated in this, or is that something separate?
I have a future slide about payroll growth that might answer the question, but feel free to ask a question through the chair if I don't do an adequate job.
We'll go on to slide 21 again.
Okay.
So could you go back over that second paragraph? That's been brought up many times at the table, but not.
Okay. The legislature responded by capping employer rates at 22% for PERS and 12.56% for TERS, with the state covering the difference. In 2012, the board adopted level dollar amortization to be more aggressive. Then in 2014, the legislature made two important moves. It infused $3 billion into the system, and it changed the amortization method back to level percent of payroll while extending the timeline from 2030 to 2039.
Okay. And the first sentence on the second paragraph? You missed that. Contribution rates surged.
Oh, that was in the first paragraph. In 2006, the Army Board adopted a 2025-year schedule to pay off unfunded liabilities by 2030. By 2007 and 2008, contribution rates had surged to unsustainable levels. Fairbanks was phasing PERS rates of 180% of payroll. Anchorage School District saw TERS rates jump from 26% to 54%, which more than doubled.
Okay. And we've talked about that issue here. Any other questions on this slide? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Williams, the second and the fourth changes that are listed here, were those recommendations by the Arms Board, or did the legislature act on its own?
The Arm Board made the decision to
2007 and 2008, changing the rate when the rates were 26% to 54%. And the setting the employer rate at 22% for PERS and 12.56 for TERS. Were those recommendations by the board?
I don't believe the Arm Board made a recommendation on what the cap rate would be. I think the Arm Board was very cognizant of what the effects were, but they were setting a rate to pay off the liability in the timeline they have. So the Arm Board works with the structure that it had and set the rate, and that the legislature responded to.
And in 2014, the infusion of $3 billion, was that a recommendation by the Arms Board?
I believe the Arm Board was. I don't know if they had a formal recommendation. I know there were there was strong support for that happening.
I think. As I recollect, both of those were actions that the legislature took after hearing reports from the Arm Board and from the municipalities, particularly Fairbanks, which if we did not take action would have been bankrupt.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I knew there was support within the board. I do not know if there was a formal resolution or recommendation from it.
Next slide, please.
The $3 billion infusion meaningfully improved funding ratios. PERS went from around 60% to 67%. TERS jumped from 53% to 77%. That was very significant. But the change to level percent of payroll combined with the 9-year extension to 2039 also came with some effects. The actuary estimated those structural changes added approximately $5 billion in total cost in nominal dollars, as documented in the 2018 ISA report. The payments were smaller up front, but the interest kept compounding. And so I think here's a result that I think we've been kind of discussing a little bit throughout this presentation. Despite the $3 billion infusion, funded ratios remained essentially flat for 8 years after 2015. PERS hovered in the mid to high 60s. TERS stayed in the mid to high 70s. We didn't start seeing meaningful movement until the last couple of years, with PERS now at 70.3% and TERS at 79.8% as of 2025.
I think, Mr. Williams, that's all good, the percentages, but one of the things we work here is in dollars. Mm-hmm. Dollars is what makes the budget imbalance or balance. Mm-hmm. So that's why we keep bringing up the unfunded liability not moving, or actually moving against us over the last 10 years, even though the percentage of coverage has improved into the high 70s, which is good, so the public doesn't have to be alarmed. It's not going to, the system's not going to implode. If it was at 50% or some number, it would definitely be concerning, or 60. So anyway, we had a similar request from a previous presenter not to forget the dollars.
Okay. Thank you. Slide 24. I will just note that I think this is another part of the presentation where I have a higher probability that it might meet the threshold of riveting, but I could be wrong. This table illustrates the mechanics of two methods on a $1 million unfunded liability with a 2.75% payroll growth assumption. Under level dollar, which is like a standard mortgage payment, you pay a fixed $82,000 every year, and the balance continues to drop. Under level percent of payroll, the early payments are smaller, $64,000 in year one, and they grow over time with payroll. But notice that in the early years, the liability actually increases because the payments aren't covering the interest. After 13 years of payments, the liability has only dropped from $1 million to $900,000 under level percent of payroll. So if we add a $1 million layer of debt with 25-year amortization, the debt increases for 6 years, and after 13 years of payments, we still owe $900,000 of debt on that particular layer. If you continue to look at this, you'll see that you can make payments for 21 years and you have to pay for more than 21 years to pay off more than half the debt. And I'll just say that the ARM board found this troubling, the effects of this. And I think this is one of those things that you're making payments, but you're not seeing the progress that you want to see.
But should we not be making progress? Or is this...
to the chair is that this is one of the biggest differences between 25-year amortization and 15-year amortization, which the board moved to. So you have a policy on layering with 25-year amortization. You pay for 21 years, and you're paid off about half the debt. And with 15-year amortization, you pay for 15 years, and the whole debt's paid off. And so one of the concerns the board had is that with 25-year amortization policies, not on the original debt from 2014, 2015, but on new layers of debt of experience, you're pushing a lot of debt way off into the future. And so paying off those, if you have an experience that is negative, a new layer of debt, paying off over a shorter period of time makes a lot of sense actuarially.
So if I could, Mr. Williams, and this has been mentioned before, that taking the example of a 45-year-old worker in Alaska that started in the business or in the workforce at age 25 for the last 20 years, they've been burdened with this unfunded liability that has affected all our communities in the states, and the money could have went to lots of things, right? Salaries, benefits, education, roads, whatever, lower taxes, all that stuff. But now they're 45 years old, and they got another 20 years to go. Their entire working careers been burdened by liabilities created in the 70s, 80s, and 90s before they were even born, or right after they were born, thereabouts. They went into the workforce if they're 25 in 2005, roughly. So it is a problem to some of us shifting liabilities onto our grandchildren. So that's one of the reasons why there's such a concern that we're not making as much progress as we'd like.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. I'll just say I think the board shares that concern.
And I'd also like to mention that when we looked at the future contributions on the schedule here by Mr. Gallagher here a few days ago, they're showing $232 million for FY27 and $202 million in FY38, and it basically bounces somewhere around the mid-200s all the way up. There's only a couple of years when it's slightly under $200 million. All the way up to 2039. So I think we need to have some conversations with OMB or whatever on what we put in our budgets and how we deal with this also. So anyway, I just thought I'd point that out, that moving these liabilities continually forward to somebody else's problem is... At least I don't think it's the right thing to do.
Okay. When we talked briefly before the meeting, Chair Stedman, I think this is the slide you said you're going to push back on, and I should be prepared for that. So I am prepared. So this table is worth spending a moment on because it shows another part of the problem. The left column shows the valuation assumptions, inflation, and payroll growth. For years, the payroll growth assumption was set as inflation plus a margin. So inflation was 3.5%, payroll growth was assumed to be 4%. When inflation came down to 2.5%, payroll growth was still assumed at 2.75%. Now, when you look at the right columns, what actually happened? In 2014, PERS payroll actually shrank by 1.7%. Now, this isn't salary shrinking. But it's the overall payroll shrank by 1.7%, while the assumption said it would grow 3.62%. That gap is over 5 percentage points. TERS was even worse that year, negative 2% against a 3.62% assumption. In 2018, PERS was negative 1.03% against a 2.75% assumption. For several years, the assumption overstated the reality, sometimes by 2 points, sometimes by 4 points or more. Why does this matter? The whole theory behind level percent of payroll amortization is that payroll will grow over time, so we can afford to make smaller payments now because future payrolls will be much larger and the same percentage will generate much bigger dollar contributions down the road. But when payroll doesn't grow the way the assumption says it will, those larger payrolls never materialize. The bigger dollar contributions we were counting on don't show up, and the result is that more debt gets deferred further and further into the future, and that's what happened.
Okay. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Is this kind of similar to the demographic challenges that, say, Social Security had, where you have a shrinking working base, and you have a growing retiree base. So in other words, you're not feeding the system. Is it a similar dynamic, just on a different scale?
I would say that it's kind of two different philosophies on paying off debt. One of them, the level dollar method, which the board adopted, I think 2012, 2013, was let's just pay this off like a mortgage. Every month, make this payment until we get it down. The level percent of payroll is trying to assume that the payroll is going to grow, and normally the payroll does grow. But if you do that, you really have to be accurate about how much it's going to grow. Otherwise, you can think you can make much smaller payments now to and that it's going to work out, you're paying the same percentage later. And so it's not like someone's salary was shrinking then, but the overall payroll was shrinking, and so that assumption didn't happen. So I would say if you're using that amortization method, you have to be very vigilant to have an accurate, be very careful what you're looking at in terms of how that payroll is going to grow, because you're using that as a strategy to make your payments smaller now.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, I would think you have to also look at the, I guess, the demographics within the cohort mm-hmm. that's affected by the plan. So I'm picturing like a couple of bell curves that overlaid. So people who are still working and then people who are retired, and the two different effects on the system. Is there any information that displays that current situation?
Through the chair, I would have to ask our actuary if they've done any modeling of that.
Thank you.
So this shows we looked at the geometric average over the last 10 years, and you'll see over the last 10 years, the geometric average is for payroll growth is 2.09% for PERS and 0.76% for TERS. And so having a payroll growth assumption of 2.75%, this slide puts the averages together. The PERS actual payroll growth averaged 2.09%, TERS averaged just 0.76%, both well below the 2.75% assumption the system had been using. For TERS and PERS, that gap meant less money coming in every single year than the funding schedule anticipated. That's why we adjusted the payroll growth assumption in 2025. We set PERS to 2% and TERS to 1%, which is better aligned with what our actual experience is. And I understand that those, if you're looking at thinking of salary or looking at anything else, that seems low. But we've seen for a fairly long period of time, we have had a payroll growth assumption that is remarkably higher than what we've experienced, and we need to be more accurate with that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Williams, one of the few things of Senate Bill 141 back in 2005 that I liked was that it created an ARM board. So we didn't have a separate PERS board, and pension investment board. One of the other things is that it required actual experience studies of mm-hmm. what's been going on in our system and how they compare to our assumptions. So it looks like this particular assumption has been off for quite a while. Is there a reason that you're able to point to through history why it's hasn't been adjusted a little closer to actual experience?
Through the chair, I want to choose my words carefully. I think there has been a practice by actuaries over long periods of time to look at the inflation rate and add a little bit of a margin there and say this is our payroll growth assumption. And so if you look over time, you can see that you can see that it was at the payroll growth assumption was at 4%, and it wasn't meeting that, and so they dropped it all the way down. So now it's at 2.75%, because they're like, well, so that's kind of the way they adjusted it. What I would say is, as the chair of the board and on the committees and trustee questions, was kind of like, we need to adjust this. And one of the questions that came back was the experience study. Well, let's wait till our next experience study. And I kept coming back and saying, we know what the payroll growth is every year. Why do we need an experience study to do that? And why can't we change it? So we don't need to wait for an experience study. I think we have enough now that we can change it. So I would just say that I think it's very common for pension boards across the country to go with an inflation rate and then having a margin to adjust it. And I would just say that the board felt strongly to look at what our experience was and what we were seeing. And we see that every year, and setting a rate that more accurately reflected that.
And so, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is it the board's opinion that where we are now, inflation plus 25 basis points, is the right level? Because when I look at slide 27, I'm not sure those numbers are inflation plus 25 basis points.
Yeah, we are not using that practice now, because we still have a 2.5% inflation rate. If we added 25 basis points, we would keep the 2.75%. We changed it in 2025. We changed PERS down to 2%, and we changed PERS down to 1%, which is what we're seeing with experience. So I would describe it as there was one strategy for how you set payroll growth assumptions, and then I think the board got to a point where saying, well, this isn't really what we're seeing, and we're going to look at what we're seeing, and we're going to set a more accurate payroll growth assumption.
If I could, before we jump off of this, you know, the hindsight's 20/20 when we look, even when we look back at the growth in the liability versus going forward. I would just like the board to think about that we have the salary study that's out that we're going to have here at the table. We've got problems throughout most of our agencies because salary levels are not keeping up with the private enterprise, especially at the lower levels. So we're having trouble filling those positions. And in my opinion, teachers are underpaid relative to the other states. So if you look backwards over a couple of decades or a decade or half a decade, particularly a decade, that salary growth that we experience is probably not going to be similar to what's coming at us. And regardless of affordability or anything, just the mechanics of trying to run the state when you can't, fill OCS as an example, the latest one in the newspaper. But there's a litany of agencies that have problems. So I just caution you to try to Ouija board forward versus looking back with a clear view, because I don't think that what's coming at us is going to be similar to the last. To the last decade.
Through the chair, thank you for those comments. I think we don't necessarily want to be changing the payroll growth assumption every single year or pivoting back and forth. I think if we start to see evidence that there's a different payroll growth assumption than what we're experiencing or what we project over the next few years, I believe we would make those adjustments.
Okay, fair enough.
So I want to show you some of the effects of a 25-year amortization with a 2.75% payroll growth assumption. In 2018, the board adopted layered amortization, and we did that because as you get closer and closer to 2039, if there's a big market return, it makes sense to be able to layer things. And at the time, we were told that we had to use 25-year periods of amortization. And I will say that the several trustees raised concerns about the 25-year period. And at the time, we were told we need to do layering, and it had to be 25-year period amortization. Within a few years, the combination of 25-year layers and an overestimated payroll growth pushed over $2 billion in unfunded liability past 2039. Just once again, when you have that, you got 13 years of payments on a typical layer. Only about 10% would be paid off after 13 years. You have to pay for 21 years to pay off half of it. So it just pushed an awful lot of debt way down the road. The board's concern was straightforward. If we kept extending and refinancing, we'd turn a finite payoff plan into an open-ended obligation. That is not something we wanted to see. And when we saw that tendency, that was a pattern we wanted to break. So in 2025, we had Resolution 2025-04. In March 2025, the ARM Board adopted Resolution 2025-04, which formalized the shift to shorter amortization layers. The key principle is tailored amortization. And so we recognize the original unfunded liability in 2015 as a 25-year amortization period. That's in statute. But shorter periods for year-to-year fluctuations, the board, and this is in consultation with Department of Law and our ARM Board Council, believes it retains the authority to set layers shorter than 25 years, consistent with best actuarial practices. In 2023 and 24, I mentioned the concerns of how much debt had been pushed out. The ARM Board deliberately set rates to avoid creating new layers at all. And we wanted to have layers that for shorter period of times to prevent that backloading problem. The, you know, just as a reminder once again, that 25-year layer, you only pay off about 10% of the debt after 13 years of payment. A 15-year layer, you've paid off 100% of it after 15 years. So here's a comparison. Under 15-year layers, the state pays less across every category in nominal dollars. PERS additional state contributions, $34 million less. PERS total state as employer, $168 million less. TERS additional state, $18 million less. The critical number looking at unfunded liability remaining after 2039 under a 25-year layers, we still have $122 million in PERS employer obligations that would extend past the target date. Under 15-year layers, that drops to $8 million projected. That's $114 million less deferred past the finish line that we've set and are hoping to meet. I want to be clear what the board did in 2023 and 24. We deliberately chose not to create new layers at all. We just said, what's the payment we would make now this year to pay this thing off by 2039? As you get closer and closer to 2039, that gets harder and harder to do, so having a layering policy makes sense. But we selected contribution levels that would keep us on a trajectory to fully pay off the unfunded liability by fiscal year 2039. In 2025, we implemented the 15-year layering. The comparison on this slide shows $220 million in total savings under 15-year layers versus 25-year layers. But the $220 million isn't really the point, even though that's a lot of money. The bigger risk with 25-year amortization is what happens when, not if, we hit some negative experience. If we had kept 25-year layers and then absorbed a couple of bad years, we could quickly repeat exactly what happened after 2018, where we moved billions of dollars past 2039 in a relatively short period of time. 15-year layers help protect against that. They keep the system on a finite payoff, even when experience doesn't go our way.
So what you're telling us is that there's some risk here in the 25-year, that individual Alaskan that's been burdened by this for 20 years and has got 20 more to go, if they're 45 now, they'll be 65 retire. It could haunt them all the way through their retirement.
Through the chair, I think, yes. And I think one of the things, like in 2018, when we made that layering decision with 25-year amortization. And all, a few years later, we had $2 billion past that. One of my questions, like, why isn't anyone yelling at us? And, you know, I think if there's a time machine from the future, future ARM boards or other people would come back and would, but it did reduce the costs in the near term, but 25 years really sets up a situation where you're deferring it too far and you're making too many payments and you're not really seeing the progress you need to see.
So to get to that point, and again, just bringing up the current budget, is that the difference between what the ARM board proposes for $270 million for TERS and PERS versus what the governor proposes, which is $232 million, and again, 270 down to 232. That's 15-year amortization versus the 25. Is that correct, or do you know? You can get back to us
I
thought,
with that. Well, I think I'll do it now. I thought I would get a question like this, and I thought I have to answer this very carefully. And so here's what I will say, because I know that there's a difference in funding levels, and I don't know all the rationale behind it. But what I will say is the Alaska Retirement Management Board has 9 trustees, including 2 commissioners, and the 15-year amortization policy, along with the updated payroll growth assumptions, was adopted without any opposition. All of the trustees serving on the board were appointed by the governor, and we are grateful for the trust he has placed in us to carry out our fiduciary responsibilities. I do think there's a natural tension between fiduciary best practices that focus on long-term system health and the very real financial pressures that exist in the near term. The board's statutory responsibility is to set the PERS and TERS contribution rates each year, and we take that responsibility very seriously. We completed that work thoughtfully and with great care at our September 2025 board meeting. Using the actuarial assumptions and amortization policies, we believe are in the best long-term interest of the systems.
Hey, we're not trying to get between you and the governor that does the appointments. We understand that, mm-hmm. The difficulty it puts all his appointees. Mm-hmm. So we'll have that discussion with the OMB director when we go through the budget process, the 25 to 15-year amortization, the $270 million in the budget, or the $232 million. It's about $40 million, and the $40 million is not an easy number to get to here at the table. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, it's awful tough budget. So, and the governor has his red pen. So if we put in the extra $40 million, he could just very well take it out. We recognize that, so we want to work with the administration jointly to get the debt unfunded liability retired as soon as possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Stedman. I think the board sets a contribution rate, and I think we set the best long-term practice contribution rate. After that, there's a process with the legislature and the governor to decide how much or how to fund that rate. And I think that's the process that's in right now. But what I will say, the fiduciary duty and responsibility that the board has to set that contribution rate, we put our best thinking on it. We thought we wanted to do what was best in the long term, and I believe we have fulfilled that role.
Okay.
Chair Stedman and committee members, I'd now like to turn to 4 resolutions the board has adopted recommending specific improvements to the defined contribution system. We're approaching 20 years with the defined contribution system. The employees hired after 2006 are now mid-career, and with 2 decades of experience, the ARM board has identified areas where the system can be strengthened. I want to share these with humility. We understand the legislature has many competing priorities. We try to be thoughtful about that. We've looked for adjustments that aren't incredibly expensive, but that would fundamentally improve the system for the people in it. We've tried to find proposals where people who rarely agree on anything might actually agree. Part of our fiduciary responsibility is not just managing the investments and setting contribution rates. It's also sharing our best thinking on issues we've spent a lot of time wrestling with and deepening our understanding of the issues. The board has spent years studying these coverage gaps. It is in this spirit that we bring these forward, possibly for your consideration. And I'll just say, you don't have to fall in love with all four. We will be quite understanding if you only fall in love with one or two. So, the first one, Resolution 2025-01, removes barriers to health care. The current law requires defined contribution members to retire directly from the plan and be actively employed for 12 consecutive months immediately before retirement to qualify for retiree medical, even if they've already completed 30 years of service or 25 for peace officers and firefighters. The Armed Board recommends removing that requirement for 30-year and 25-year pathways. If someone has given the state 30 years of service, they've earned the benefit. They shouldn't have to go find a covered job at age 64 to check a box. We do recommend retaining the 12-month requirement for age 65 with 10-year pathway where the service threshold is lower. Just for example, you can consider a 60-year-old who leaves state employment after 30 years but doesn't want to start paying the full premium yet. Defined contribution members pay the full premium until they reach Medicare age. And so they may want to, if they're retiring before that age, they may want to plan when they start the retirement. So they might, the 60-year-old might want to start taking the coverage at age 65 when Medicare kicks in. Under current law, they'd have to go back to a covered position at 64, work a year, and then retire directly. That's not a reasonable requirement for someone who's already completed 3 decades of service. The resolution also allows interest to accrue on HRA accounts for members who leave and return, replacing the CPI-only method. One thing I'll note on this, I have spoken with Division of Retirement and Benefits, and they have suggested that in certain situations, if someone has covered service, they may allow flexibility as to when someone takes that. However, when I talked to our Armed Board Council and I talked to Department of Law, they said, that may be something that's said now, but you have to look at what the statute says, and the statute's fairly clear, and it may be interpreted differently by DRB 5 years or 10 years from now. And so I think having a change to the statute makes sense. Resolution 2025-02 reduces years of service for retiree medical. And the defined contribution retiree medical plan members pay 100% of premiums before age 65. After 65, the plan becomes secondary to Medicare and subsidizes only a portion of the premium. Requiring 30 years of service, including 30 years of employer contribution to access coverage that is secondary to Medicare, may be more restrictive than necessary, especially for like TERS members who don't participate in Social Security or the supplemental benefit system. This resolution presents 3 options for reducing the service requirement. One would be 25 years for all employees. One would be a 25-20 split, 20 years for peace officers and firefighters, 25 years for everyone else. And the third one would be 20 years for all employees. Before going through details, I do want to make one note. The actuarial analysis in our materials was based on 2023 evaluations. We're finalizing updated numbers on the 2025 valuation with our actuary GRS. I was exchanging some texts and emails with our actuary over the weekend, but we plan to update our resolutions. The cost relationships, the percentage impact on each option, we probably expect to see somewhat similar. The baseline liabilities have grown, so the dollar amounts will be somewhat higher. But we do plan to update our resolutions with the 2025 evaluations as soon as possible. The actuarial analysis from GRS shows all 3 options. The 25-year option keeps both plans above 100%. The 25-20 split also keeps both plans funded, though PERS is tighter. My expectation, just based on some exchanges over the weekend, I think the 25-20 split that 104% is going to come closer to 100%. I also see the 20 years of service. If you add it up, it's going to cost $47.50 million. It's going to cost more than that, and we'll get those numbers. I do want to note, I think there can be a cost to the delay on these changes every year that goes by. As the accrued liabilities continue to grow, the same policy change becomes more expensive in absolute dollars the longer we wait because the normal cost has not changed. And so what I will say is one of the things I heard when we had these options was the 20 years for everyone is never going to happen because it would take $50 million. The bad news, that's changed. It's going to be more than $50 million now. But I did want to think about an employee who's served 20 years and with the state of Alaska or as a municipality, and if can they get something more than, and they leave service, can they get something more than just their HRA account balance? And so the resolution 2025-21 looked at the possibility, and I think Chair Stedman, you mentioned coming up with $50 million is incredibly difficult, or even more than that. And so one of the things we try to be creative with is trying to identify a funding mechanism for the 20-year option using a one-time transfer from the health reimbursement arrangement balances that are expected to be forfeited. The HRA is funded solely by employer contributions at 3% of compensation. Over long periods of time, the investment returns turn out to be much more than that. But members vest after 10 years of service. Those who leave before vesting will forfeit their balance unless they return. As of June 2025, 56,770 former members who left before vesting hold $334 million in unvested HRA balances. Based on return to service analysis, we think probably around $285 million of that is conservatively estimated to be highly likely to be permanently forfeited. So this resolution was sized at approximately $50 million based on the 2023 valuation. That amount will need to be updated. But the forfeiture pool of $285 million is more than sufficient. It's non-recurring. It doesn't touch active or vested accounts. And the money stays within the participant medical benefit system as required by the statute. And so this trust right now has over $1 billion in it. About $334 million of that right now is by unvested former employees that probably aren't going to be coming back. And when we looked at the possible return rate, one of the things I looked at is the DBE plan return rate. The DBE plan is much more generous and should have a higher incentive to return. And but we choose similar return rates or even more conservative, and we still came up with a possible $285 million that we think could possibly be used to reduce years of service requirements or bring other benefits to medical care. Resolution 2025-22, disability and healthcare coverage gaps. Under the prior DB tiers, members had occupational and non-occupational disability coverage, and they had health care during disability. Under the current DC tier, occupational disability exists, but without health care. Non-occupational disability is simply not provided. The Armed Board has received direct testimony on multiple occasions by members on occupational disability describing the stress of not having health care coverage. The Occupation, Death, and Disability Trust funds only income replacement. They do not cover health care. Those trusts are well overfunded, PERS at 399%, TERS at 5,000%. They can absorb the cost of adding non-occupational disability income at 40% of salary. Health care during disability is a different matter. In the DC Retiree Medical Plan today, members who retire before 65 pay 100% of their own premiums. After Medicare at 65, the plan subsidizes a portion. No member currently receives plan-paid pre-Medicare coverage. Adding health care for disabled members would be the only situation where the retiring medical trust pays pre-Medicare premiums, which cost retiree medical trust, which costs several times more per person than post-Medicare. That cost comes from the retiree medical trust, not the disability trust, because of how the trusts are structured in statute. Want to make sure you're aware, both this resolution on the disability and the years of service reduction would tap some of the surplus of that same retiree medical thing. So if only one of them were instituted, that holds up. But if you institute both of them, you'd be kind of tapping the same surplus, and there might be need for an HRA to cover it. I think the analysis I saw, and it was just very tentative, but if for instance, the 20-year were implemented and the disability coverage, it would need about somewhere around $110 million. So those, just knowing that we looked at things by each resolution, but if more than one, if the disability and the years of service were adjusted at the same time, there would be a compound effect there that would need to be addressed. So the Arm Board recommends two changes. First, to add healthcare coverage for disabled defined contribution members, both occupational and non-occupational. Second, extend disability income to non-occupational disabilities for members with at least 10 years of service. Currently, the defined benefit members have non-occupational disability without 10 years of service. I think the Arm Board is a fairly conservative organization. We looked at Texas and we looked at New York, two fairly politically different states, and they both have pension systems that have a 10-year, need 10 years of covered service for non-occupational disability. I do want to share, I believe the slide had noted that non-occupational disability was for 85% of covers. 85% of people with disability, 15% is occupational. I did get an update from our actuary. That is true for TERS. 85% are non-occupational disabilities. For police and firefighters, it's 30%. And for PERS other, it's 65%. So across all groups, a significant share of the members most likely to become disabled do not have any coverage. So, in summary, this slide summarizes the four resolutions. Each one addresses a real gap in the current system, and we've worked hard to find paths that are fiscally responsible. We're working with our review actuary to update our analysis to the most recent valuation and plan to update our resolutions. Chair Stedman, that concludes my presentation.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Williams, I knew it would be riveting. It's kind of a complex subject matter with lots of moving parts and has impact all across the state. So do we have final questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you've seen a report that came to all six co-chairmen, three in the House and three in the Senate, from the director, OMB director, but giving us a report that's required that shows that incentive and overtime payments for a six-month period was $4.6 million. And I've discussed it with the co-chairman. This number is continuing to rise. I wouldn't bring this up, but it's going north at double-digit rates. Going through the report, and it's quite extensive. There's literally hundreds of employees that fall under this category. I know that the employees' agreements are set by the bargaining units, but somewhere along the line in this report, I've seen employees, particularly in corrections, and in the public safety department, doubling their salary on an annual basis. This is a little bit, and therefore doubling the cost of retirement. And some of them are able to do this with double time under the rates. And as a result of that, a normal person has to work 25 years to get his high rates, 20, 25 years. But in 3 short years, some of these employees are doubling their retirement benefits, whether it's 3 years or 5 years. That should be troubling, and I'm wondering if the board can look at that and see if they do more research and to see if they feel that that is a problem area that needs to be addressed by... I don't think that it's intentionally gaming the system, but in direct results, that's what's happening, where people are potentially doubling their retirement for 3 or 5 years for the rest of their retirement life. So I'd make that request.
Through the chair, I...
Understanding it would take laws, changing the laws that govern some of the benefits that that may be looked at, and closing those loopholes so that they can't go through that in contract negotiations.
Through the chair, I'm not sure how the Armed Board would look at it. I guess my only comment would be that those are things with the defined benefit system. Those certainly not things in the defined contribution system, and that they're putting money into an account that is growing, and then when they leave, they have access to that account. There's no guarantee on that. And that, you know, that it there's a lot of, we oversee a lot of different systems, but like there's a lot of teachers or other things where there is no overtime in there. But that strikes me as it may be a DRB or some sort of analysis to kind of see how big of an issue that is.
Thank you.
It's a big one. We've been trying to get our hands around it the last couple of years, or the last several years. Do we have other questions, Senator Kaufman?
Thank you, through the chair. I think the last comment, I think it's just on the heels of the difference towards the end of the presentation, which was on defined contributions as opposed to defined benefits. So that concern of kind of the paycheck risk is specific to defined benefits.
Yes, it is.
Yes, sir.
Any other final comments, questions for Mr. Williams? He was spent several days preparing for us.
And one final comment, and I bring this up because still on the table is legislation to bring back defined benefits.
So,
through the chair, just a comment. The resolutions that we have recommended, whether there is a return to defined benefit or if there's not a return to defined benefit, they still matter because the retiree health care system is going to be, for defined contribution members, is still going to be the same. Even if it's changing the pension, it's not changing the retiree medical system. So these resolutions should be applicable and have interest to whichever side of that issue people are on.
Okay. Any other questions, concerns for Mr. Williams? I'd like to thank you, Ms. Jones, for coming forward today. It'll conclude the meeting this afternoon. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., that's 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, we're going to have 5 pieces of legislation up. First is Senate Joint Resolution 2, Constitutional Amendment, Votes Needed for Veto Override. Senate Bill 104, Vehicles, Boats, Transfer on Death, Title. SB 140, Fire Station Grant Program. Senate Bill 21, Alaska Work and Save Program, Retire and Savings Board. And Senate Bill 211, Extend Occupational Licensing Boards. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., Senator Hoffman will be chairing those. We'll see everybody here 9 a.m. It is now 2:56 by that clock. 57 by the other clock. We'll average it as we do in the pension plan. We'll smooth it out, and we are adjourned.